TalkZone.com.
Now, the Wild About Pets radio show, the place to learn something new about household pets and wild animals. Here's your host, educator and naturalist, Susan Frank.
Hello, welcome to Wild About Pets, sponsored by Nutrisource, a super premium dog food. On this show, we talk in depth to leading authors and experts about all topics regarding household pets or wild animals. To make your listening experience more enjoyable and meaningful, I created a companion website, wildaboutpets.net, that allows you to see photographs of the animals we'll be talking about on the show today. To see these pictures while you're listening, click the purple Look While You Listen button you see inside today's episode page, dated November 12th, or on the TalkZone Wild About page homepage. Then just click today's date and show title until you see the page of photos. I am a big fan of the animal scientist Temple Grandin, so I want to tell you about an event. I interviewed her on my show, and perhaps you saw a movie about her on HBO. I fell in love with her books, Animals in Translation and Animals Make Us Human. Temple Grandin will be speaking at a workshop in the Chicagoland area for any of you who live around here. And what's wonderful about her is, due to her autism, she has a unique understanding of animals. She is going to be speaking on November 20th at a great dog facility called For Your Canine. Canine is spelled the letter K dash the number 9, and it's in Melrose Park, Illinois, again on Saturday, November 20th from 9 to 4:30. For more information, you'll be contacting www.foryourcanine.com. The link to that website is on my page of photos for today's show. Another event for some of you in the Chicagoland area, I will be appearing at 2 Pet Supplies Plus stores demonstrating pet first aid techniques as part of the store's Home for the Holidays events. They're going to be taking place on December 5th at the Pet Supply Store in Naperville North, and then again on December 12th at the Villa Park Store. There's going to be a number of adoption and rescue groups present, and I'll be handing out samples of pet food from my sponsor, Nutrisource. I really like this pet food because it comes from a family-owned company. They manufacture their own food, and it has the ingredients I think are beneficial for your pet and leaves out the ones that are not. Do you wish that sometimes you could understand your dog better? Be able to figure out what your dog is trying to communicate to you through its behavior? Why does it keep barking or get so crazy aggressive when another dog walks by? Doesn't it know not to keep pooping or peeing on your bed? You try to train your dog. You have heard the advice. You, the human, must be in control. Show the dog who the boss is. But it's confusing which methods are best, and they don't always seem to work anyway. Do you wonder, how do you get your dog to cooperate, and what is the dog thinking anyway? My guest today, Jennifer Arnold, has written the book Through a Dog's Eyes, Understanding Our Dogs by Understanding How They See the World, and she has answers for you. You see, Jennifer has had 20 years experience teaching dogs to do some of the most unusual and often complex things that we normally don't even think of asking our dogs to do. My theme today is, if she can teach skills to dogs that can make the difference literally between life and death for some people, then there are things we can surely learn from her to get our dog to come when called or to sit. So what is this unusual job where she has earned her expertise? What method of training does she use? And what insights does Jennifer have into the minds of dogs? Let's find out. Welcome, Jennifer. I'm thrilled to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Arnold is the founder and executive director of Canine Assistance, a nonprofit organization, and was the subject of a PBS documentary. Our phone lines are open today. It's November 12th. To call and ask Jennifer a question, call 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888. Go for it. And I have some photos to accompany our conversation. To see them, click the purple Look While You Listen button in today's episode page or on the TalkZone homepage. You will also find some links to a few YouTubes that gives us a preview of the PBS show and demonstrates Jennifer's teaching method for dogs. I also will recommend you go to YouTube and look at all her great, great videos. Jennifer, it was wonderful to see you demonstrating your teaching methods.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay, so let's get to finding out how to better understand our dog. Jennifer, first of all, you have 20 years' experience working with and observing dogs do some of the most amazing things through your organization, Canine Assistance. What does this organization do?
Well, we train assistance dogs for people who have difficulty with mobility, use wheelchairs, maybe need a little help with balance. We also work with people who have epilepsy. And our dogs are trained to respond in the event that someone has a seizure, but the vast majority of them actually develop the ability to anticipate that a seizure is going to happen at some point in the near future, usually about 10 to 40 minutes in advance of onset, which is remarkable.
That is remarkable, and later on we'll talk about a little bit of that. And as we talk about all the things, the insights you've learned, the idea that these dogs can anticipate, I mean, that goes so far beyond sometimes, you know, what the cues, or as people call them, commands, but I know we're going to be using the word cue today, and later on you can explain why, what we ask our dogs to do. There is a picture, number two, by the way, that shows one of these service dogs with one of the recipients, and we'll be seeing many more photographs. Again, to see these pictures, just click the purple Look While You Listen buttons you see on the episode page or the Talk Zone page. Jennifer, where do the dogs come from that are that wind up accompanying and living with various people?
We actually used to use all dogs that were adopted from rescue programs, and I felt very, very strongly about that. I still believe very strongly that there are a number of dogs who can come out of, you know, shelters and from rescue programs that can be taught to do this kind of work and can sort of survive it emotionally. As we got bigger, we couldn't find enough dogs, so we have also a breeding program. So now we do both. And, you know, I can't tell you that there's not a difference in the puppies that we raise from birth, because there is.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I mean, it's hard sometimes to go back and instill that trust in an animal that's been so betrayed as to have been abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
But we certainly do find dogs that make it. And my great dog love of my life was from a shelter, so it can work both ways.
Yes, and that's Nick, and actually we have a picture of Nick. We're looking at photograph number 5, and Nick used to go in, I guess, to a lot of hospitals and clinics and would comfort sick and dying, and this is Dr. Nick.
Dr. Nick. We called it Dr. Nick. That's my dad. In the photograph, you see an old-fashioned black medical bag, and that was my dad's black bag. So that was important to me, and Nick would carry it in his mouth and had a little pager on his scrub top that he wore with a stethoscope, and he was hot stuff.
Yes, and didn't you say that it was children who nicknamed him Dr. Nick?
It was, yes, and he actually ended up with a prescription pad on which I would write what Dr. Nick told me to write, which actually we had found out from the nurses before our visit.
Of course.
Like, Billy needs to work on eating a little bit more.
Oh, that is so great. And then you'd hand that to the parent or the...
Absolutely. That's Dr. Nick's prescription. And he went back to check on it whenever he could. So.
And you know, in the innocence and trust of children, I'm sure they took that very much to heart.
Oh, absolutely.
So, what or how are the people who will receive the dogs chosen?
That is probably the most horrifying part of my job.
Is it?
Most of it is wonderful, but we have several thousand people on a waiting list, and we can train between about 80 and 100 dogs a year. In this economy, which has hurt us very badly just lately, which is kind of weird, but it finally sort of caught up to us. The people that are selected are chosen based on how much a dog can do to help them physically, socially, and emotionally, and then how appropriate the placement is for the dog. And it's a numerical ranking system, not first come, first served, which everybody knows when they apply, but it's still heartbreaking to have so many people that you know you could help if you just, you know, had more yes. of everything, mostly funding.
Yes. Now, Jennifer, are you unusual in this field? Are there many more of these organizations, and yours is a non-for-profit, canine assistance around the country, around the world?
Well, there are, and it's growing, and that's one thing that we really want to see happen is this continued growth of the industry as a whole, because that's the only thing that's ever going to, you know, sort of whittle down the waiting list. I think where we may be a little bit different we are the only program of which I'm aware that provides lifetime upkeep for the dogs. If the family needs that, we'll provide food, veterinary care, and recurrent training at no cost to the family. And so I think that may make us an attractive option for people who couldn't afford to have the dog otherwise.
Yes.
It makes me stay awake a lot.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
And we are also... there has been some significant criticism of working dogs as a whole, and the idea that working dogs are sort of enslaved, that they are not given a choice. And it's interesting because we really have tried for years now to be sure that everything we do is sort of based on the dog's ability to choose.
Mm-hmm.
So we really don't feel that way, but I understand it's not that way everywhere. So we'd like to sort of spread that word.
Okay, good. And we'll be talking through that because my goal here today, Jennifer, is obviously set up where you come by your expertise, and it is unusual. And again, my theme of, for heaven's sake, if you're finding your methods are highly effective with teaching these dogs to do these amazing skills and often anticipate, then we can learn much from that. And also, we're going to talk a little bit about some of what you want to say about the philosophy of some of the different dog training and kind of the dominance-based training. So we'll approach that. And then the whole idea of what does it mean for a dog to choose? And we'll be talking about what is choice teaching and then how can our listeners benefit from that. But I do want to point out again, here we have a picture number 3 at your training camp. This is obviously some of the recipients and the dogs meeting. And I was intrigued in your book that you really say when it comes down to matching a dog that has been trained to be a service dog with its person, it's the dog who does the choosing.
We have 6 of these training camps a year, and they're 2 weeks, and this is the first Friday. So this has been a new group's first week here. So I'm feeling it right now. On Tuesday afternoon, they come in on Monday morning, and by Tuesday afternoon, it used to be longer, but that people can't wait, and it doesn't take that long to see whether or not it's going to work. So we try to do it by Tuesday afternoon now. And it is pretty remarkable. I mean, the dogs will go through 5 or 6 different people, and you can tell by their body language that they're okay. They're not, you know, totally comfortable. And it's a unique situation for the dogs. They've never been through camp either. So.
Mm-hmm.
But then they'll get to that 7th person, and it all changes. You just see the dog's body relax. They crawl up in the lap. They would make eye contact, and that's it. It's over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The recipients in this group were kind of laughing about the fact that I'd say 7 out of the 12 only tried one dog, but I said, you know, that's, we nailed it. I'm getting better at this.
Right. It didn't take that. Well, you know what you're saying reminds me of the stories of people who go to a shelter and they're walking up and down. And of course, there's all those dogs who are, you know, wanting to be taken home. And usually there's this amazing connection between a person and a dog and they both just know it.
Right.
So it sounds like you find that to be true also.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's partially based on personality, maybe even largely based on personality. But there's something else that goes beyond that that I don't know how to put into words, but you know it when you see it.
Right, right. Yes, right. It's that mysterious it.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. We can feel it, we can intuit it, and we can't always name it. Well, tell us, what are some of the most common or even some of the unusual skills or tasks that service dogs will do, just so we have an idea of what are some of the things that they're doing that are making such a difference to enhance people's lives?
Well, they can, you know, sort of the easy routine things are turning lights on and off, opening and closing doors, including, you know, refrigerators, drawers, retrieving items from the floor, from the refrigerator, from a drawer, hitting a button to call 911. We have dogs that have learned how to open a door, and then they have to prop it open. So that their person, they have to block it with their body so that the person can get through the doorway without the door reclosing.
Mm-hmm.
We have a number of dogs who've learned how to assist in doing the laundry.
How do they do that?
Well, if the person has a front-loading washing machine, it's really not very difficult. I mean, all they have to do is, you know, take it from the basket, get it in the machine, and then that we have to have the button, like the start button, rewired so the dog can hit it with their nose or their paw. But it's amazing. I mean, and I think in all of this, what I find so fascinating is not the fact that the dogs are capable of doing these things, but rather that they're willing to do these things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, Jennifer, as you were talking earlier about the idea that maybe service dogs are being enslaved, I've interviewed a number of people on the show that have worked with rescue dogs, you know, the whole 9/11 dogs.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many of the canines groups, and I've... there's no mistaking that these dogs are loving what they're doing and they want to do this work. So I would believe that much more than I'd believe that, you know, we're enslaving these dogs. There's just too many stories, as I'm sure you've seen, that would discount
that. And, you know, dogs that are unhappy don't work.
Right.
So it's kind of, there's that, you know, that self-protective mechanism that keeps me from worrying about them as long as they're, you know, they're doing what they've been taught to do well. I feel like they're doing it happily.
Yes. Now, in your book, you relate many, many stories of cases of dogs doing amazing things. I mean, it'll just amaze and surprise you as you read these. I was, over and over again. So I want to call attention to that. But what I want to get to next is your primary reason, as I saw it, for writing the book, which was addressing the trend of some of the domination and control punishment training. And so we'll start this before we take a break, but let's talk about that. Jennifer, what are your feelings about that?
Well, the whole idea of dominance really is a myth. As a matter of fact, I'm not even sure that it's fair to say that dogs are pack animals like wolves are. And we got bad science on this. And you know, it started a long time ago, but it was really reinforced when doing DNA analysis allowed Robert Wayne and some of his coworkers at UCLA to say that the only genetic ancestor of the dog is the wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And people got very excited and said, we're going to run out and watch wolves. And they watched wolves in captivity, and that's like watching a human prison population.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
not representative of the reality by any stretch. And they scrapped a lot with each other, and there was this sort of constant fight for, resources that you do not see in the wild. In the wild, it tends to be mom and dad and the kids. And so there is no asserting your dominance. It just doesn't work that way. It's respect that is given to you because of your position in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what has been done in the name of having to establish oneself as the alpha over the dog is nearly criminal. Mm-hmm. I am horrified that nice people who love their dogs dearly have gotten such bad advice from so-called professional trainers that they've been told that in order to have their dog happy and well-behaved, that they have to make them afraid or force them to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not true.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the idea, I think, we think that, well, they won't respect us if we don't do that. And it is confusing, Jennifer, because throughout my life and when I've had pets, I've heard that, and I've heard so many different training methods, and sometimes I think, oh, is that what I'm supposed to be doing?
Right.
Oh, I must be doing it wrong, that I'm not as strong of the pack leader, and I'm not considered the alpha. So maybe I'm supposed to do this.
You know, that I think that has broken my heart more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
When, as I've been doing the book tour, hearing people say, I hated having to treat my dog that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we should hate it. It's not right. And it's interesting because the perception is that, you know, a strong, very manly kind of man is the ultimate in leadership. And really, dogs respond beautifully to, you know, mothering. It's fascinating to see how, you know, some of the best people I've ever seen with dogs were the least assertive.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
You know, you certainly can make the dog more afraid if you're taller and your voice is deeper and you're physically stronger, but that does so much damage to your relationship with the dog.
Yes, in photograph number 7, there's a wonderful picture of you. Who is this golden that you're with?
Oh, isn't she precious?
She's...
That's Bee.
Yes, Bee. Is this a current dog?
Mm-hmm. Well, she's in training right now.
Oh, okay. And you talk about that there is a way that you can inspire trust, and it allows the dog to solve problems, think and act out of love and inherent desire to please, which is a very different philosophy. Now, when we come back from break, I am going to ask the question, what about the dogs who do seem to have control over the household? So we'll address that. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.